This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to New Books in Catholic Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. This channel and episode were created in collaboration with the American Catholic Historical Association, a conference of scholars, archivists, and teachers of Catholic studies. My name is Carlos Ruiz Martinez, and I'm a host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Dr. Sean Brennan, who is currently a professor of history at the University of Scranton. Sean Brennan is the author of The Priest Who Put Europe Back Together, The Life of Father Fabian Flynn, published by Catholic University of America Press in 2018. In this biography, Dr. Brennan explores pivotal events in the 20th century and 20th century history, such as World War II, the Nuremberg Trials, and Eastern European revolutions through the perspective of Father Fabian Flynn and his work, an American-born Passionist priest. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
And so before we dive into the book, I am interested to know about your sort of academic formation and background. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Of course. Well, I knew I wanted to be a historian, that I was interested in religious history from very early on, from my time at Rockhurst, where I got my bachelor's. And then I went to Villanova, I got my master's there, and I knew I wanted to do something about the intersection of religion and politics in 20th century Europe, and particularly the challenges that religious institutions faced from totalitarian ideologies like fascism or communism. And my primary emphasis was in Russian history, but I had a strong secondary field in German history. And so when I got to Notre Dame to get my doctorate, and I was at Notre Dame from 2003 to 2009, and then I started Scranton in 2009, I wanted to do something that kind of merged Russian and German history and, again, religious history and political history. So my first book, my dissertation first, was about the Soviet occupation of Germany after World War II and the interaction between the East German communists, the Soviet military authorities, and the Catholic and Protestant churches there. So that's always been a consistent theme with a lot of my historical scholarship, looking at the how churches but particularly individual clergymen reacted to the tremendous challenges of the 20th century.
Great. And so turning now towards some of the content of the book. So the focus is on Father Fabian Flynn, who is a Passionist priest. And for the non-specialists, right, without getting too much into the weeds, can you tell us a little bit about the history of the Passionists in North America? I think it might be helpful for listeners to know where Father Flynn was coming from.
Sure, of course. The funny thing is, I had no knowledge about the Passionists until about 10 years ago myself. And I stumbled on the Passionists and on Fabian Flynn almost by accident. A number of years ago, in the spring of 2010, I was at a spring meeting of the American Catholic Historical Association, Princeton University. And there was a tremendous downpour, so I couldn't explore the campus, So I was looking through archival brochures, and I saw one for the Passionist Order, and it just had a really nice design. I was like, Union City, New Jersey, that's not too far away from Scranton. So that's what got me to visit the archive, and eventually we brought their archive to the University of Scranton. And I noticed the Passionists had a lot of military chaplains during the Second World War. And that's how eventually I discovered Fabian Flynn, because he was one of them. But the Passionist Order, technically, by the way, they're a congregation, but they kind of call themselves an order, and everyone calls them an order. So you'll forgive me if I call them that. Their origins go back almost 300 years. They were founded in Italy, or of course there was no Italy in 1725, but they were founded by an Italian from Piedmont named Paolo Francesco Dane. In 1725, he was given permission by Pope Benedict XIII, he and his brother, to found a congregation. He and his brother didn't become priests until 1727. It was known as the Congregation of the Passion of Our Lord Jesus Christ. Or after 1853, it's also called the Order of St. Paul of the Cross, because Paolo Dane was eventually made a saint, St. Paul of the Cross, and so the order it's kind of got named after him. Dane wanted a priest to take three traditional vows of poverty, obedience, and chastity. Let's just say poverty, especially obedience, sometimes was an issue for Father Flynn. And also a fourth one, which was a devotion to the Passion of the Divine Savior. And the Passionists were kind of a mix between a contemplative order and a dynamic order. So they weren't a completely monastic order like, say, the Trappists, but they weren't a completely dynamic order like the Jesuits or the Augustinians or perhaps the Dominicans. They were a bit of a mix between the two. But the order was based around fairly strict obedience. They close-knit community. Passionists weren't really supposed to go off and be doing things on their own. They were all supposed to live together and work together as part of an order. They did engage in a lot of missionary work. They came to the United States in 1852 from Italy. Before that, they were largely based in northern Italy, in Genoa, Piedmont. There was an attempt in the early 1800s to establish some Passionist missions in Bulgaria, which was part of the Ottoman Empire at the time. That wasn't terribly successful. But beginning in the mid-19th century, they started expanding their missionary orders to all kinds of different places, to the United States. First place in the United States they came to was Pittsburgh, and eventually they made their way to New York, to Boston, to Cincinnati, St. Louis. They also established a number of monasteries in Germany and Austria. Another prominent place was Jamaica. And then another place where they had a significant presence in the Hunan province was in China until 1950, excuse me. And so in terms of Fabian Flynn itself, a member of the Passionist Order, the Passionist Monastery in Boston is St. Gabriel's. They visited Father Flynn's church at the time when he was a teenager in Dorchester, St. Peter's Church. And he gave a presentation if anyone was interested in the order. And Flynn, who was a senior at the Boston Latin School, was very interested in it. And that drove him to eventually join the order.
And so in chapter one, you focus on Father Flynn's youth in the period between 1905 and 1924. And this period was, full of geopolitical transformations in Europe and the globe. Can you tell us a little bit about Father Flynn's early life and the world that he was born into?
Yeah, absolutely. Flynn, interestingly, the year he was born in 1905, was also the year in Boston that elected its first Irish Catholic mayor, Daniel Welton. So that was seen as finally the year in which the Catholics in Boston had reached the top of political power in the city. Because Boston, until the mid-19th century, was one of the most Protestant cities in America, if not one of the most Protestant cities in the world. And but because of significant Irish immigration in the mid-19th century and then later followed by immigration from Italy, from Portugal, to a lesser extent from Poland, from Germany, by the year of Flynn's birth, Catholics were about half the population of Boston. And so he grows up in a Catholic milieu, but he was always kind of, is always kind of an exceptional child and in kind of a different environment. He was a rare thing for a Boston Irish Catholic. He was an only child. He had an older sister, Elizabeth, who died before he was born. His father ran a number of stores at Faneuil Hall, which is a popular shopping district in Boston. People from Boston will know what I'm talking about. His mother worked as a maid, as a homemaker. Most of the Boston Irish, of course, supported the Democratic Party. Flynn's family were Republicans, which is something he kind of carried with him throughout his life. And interestingly, he, despite the fact that his family were regular churchgoers, and for most Irish Catholics in Boston, the church played a huge role, not just on Sunday, but in many parts of daily life, he didn't go to parochial schools. He went to the Boston Mather School for elementary school, which was the oldest elementary school in the world, and then the Boston Latin School for high school. And I think that was important because although he had very strong Catholic beliefs, a lot of the environments he was in meant he was interacting with people of a lot of different religious backgrounds. So, for example, when he becomes a chaplain during World War II, for some of the Catholic chaplains, it was a challenge for them because it was the first time for a lot of them they were dealing with Protestants for the first time. For Flynn, that wasn't that big of an issue. But in terms of the more broader environment, America, by entering the First World War, has kind of solidified its rising power status that had begun with the Spanish-American War in 1898. And then, of course, in Europe itself, the First World War was a devastating wave that left everything forever changed. You have four dynasties fall. The Romanovs in Russia, the Hohenzollerns in Germany, the Habsburgs in Austria, and then the Ottoman Empire as well, the Ottomans as well. And much of the rest of the 20th century is dealing with the legacy of what the war from 1914 to 1918 unleashed, and then something towards the end of that war, the Russian Revolution, and the emergence of the communist Soviet Union, and I would argue somewhat as a response to that, the emergence of various right-wing authoritarian regimes in part of Europe, and ultimately fascism in Italy and National Socialism in Germany. So it's a very tumultuous time period that Flynn himself, from writings I could find as a teenager, didn't seem too terribly aware of this. But a lot of what goes on in his youth, he's going to be dealing with the repercussions of which when he's an adult.
And so after, Flynn grows up in the Boston area and he joins the Passionists after high school. And then in chapter two, you focus on the period between 1924 and 1941. And you really dive into the writings of his work as an editor of The Sign, which is the Passionist magazine. And he was active in publishing pamphlets. And it is through these sort of different publications that we get a sense of Father Flynn's ideological leanings, right, and mm-hmm. how he views the world. Can you tell us about Flynn's view of the world and what we learned through these publications?
Well, I was always grateful when I was researching and writing this book that he wrote so much in the 30s, because the seminary period from the mid 20s to the early 30s was the toughest thing to write because there's not as much archival material I could use about him. But yeah, his writings in the 30s reveal quite a bit. I mean, this is during the Great Depression. This is when, and America doesn't face this quite as hard as Europe does, but there's a belief by some that liberal democracy, that capitalism has failed. It's time for more extreme solutions to these problems. Again, some people look towards Mussolini's regime for inspiration. Others look towards the Soviet Union. And Flynn was always a man of the right, but in that American Catholic milieu, he avoids extremes. Like he writes in his Catechism of Communism for high school students, and then, of course, just want to make sure I get the right, Catholicism, Americanism, and Communism for adults. He does offer a defense of the market economy, of democracy. He's very strongly anti-communist. But unlike someone like Father Coughlin, for example, he doesn't link communism with Judaism, for example. In a number of his writings, he was always a strong opponent of anti-Semitism, and also a fairly early critique of racial discrimination as well, saying that these type of things only assisted extremist ideologies. But he felt that he told both Catholic adults and teenagers this: you can't just say about communism that it's evil and it's atheistic and that's bad, and that's all you have to say. He said the church has to provide a good alternative of assisting the poor and helping them through times of need. And the church needs to, yes, obviously pray, but it needs to act, provide a better alternative to extremist ideologies. And also, I mean, he was also not a fan of fascist regimes either. A lot of the times, its critique of them initially is that they don't respect the independence of the church enough. But more broadly, he wasn't a fan of dictatorial regimes in general. But throughout his life, he had kind of a cynicism about politicians and people in authority, that they often made decisions, they made policies, and they didn't think of the consequences of them or the impact they would have on regular people or on refugees or on different groups. And it would be officials like him who had to deal with the consequences of that. But again, I would say he's a figure on the right of the American Catholic spectrum. And towards the end of his life, I know we'll get to this in a later question, but in the 1960s, that kind of leaves him on the outs with some American public opinion and even some friends in the church.
And a really important part of the book and Father Flynn's life is Father Flynn's service in World War II. And the way I sort of see it and conceptualize your treatment of that is that there are two parts to that. One is Father Flynn's sort of work as a chaplain for active duty troops in World War II, but then a second part where he was, he had a prominent role during the Nuremberg trials. Can you sort of tell us about those two parts of his service?
Absolutely. And it seems like that people who play a big role in certain events, sometimes pivotal historical figures, it's almost a miracle that they got to that point, or they almost got into it by accident. Because Flynn has he had health problems all of his life. He developed a stomach cancer in the late 30s. He had to have surgery that removed somewhere between 2 and 3 fifths of his stomach. And a lot of people thought he wouldn't survive. And then the order was like, well, let's just send him. He had to leave the Sign magazine, which is based in Union City, New Jersey. And he had to go. He was transferred to St. Gabriel's in Boston or in Brickton because the order figured, well, and he's from Boston, he's probably not going to live much longer, so he can die in Boston, basically. But then World War II breaks out, and almost just a few weeks after Pearl Harbor, Flynn is petitioning the members of his order, I want to enlist as a chaplain. I want to serve soldiers in either Europe or the Pacific. And I feel like it is my duty and I want to go. And they keep saying, well, you have all these health problems. Do you really think you can do it? And so he has to spend much of 1942 petitioning them. Well, they finally let him in. And so they finally do in October of 1942. He goes to the chaplain school, which was at Harvard University. So I like to joke, at least you didn't have to go very far for that. And then he spends a while at a military training base for medics in Texas. So that was kind of a culture shock for him, going there. And then he ultimately gets sent to join the 26th Infantry Regiment, which is part of the 1st Infantry Division, which was in North Africa in the summer of 1943. So he joins them in Algeria. He missed the fighting in North Africa, but he is part of the invasion of Sicily, Operation Husky, and he's with them through that entire time in Sicily. He's almost killed when a grenade goes off near him, and gets some shrapnel, some of which almost blinded him, because of residual effects of that injury. He lost sight in one of his eyes. And So he's with them with the 1st Infantry Division through Sicily, and they were called the Big Red One, famous division in the United States Army. They were also nicknamed the Bloody First because they were often first into combat. So again, one of their nicknames was the Big Dead One because they had so many casualties. And so then after Sicily, they don't take part in Operation Avalanche, the invasion of southern Italy. They go back to England in late 43. They spend the spring of 44 in England training, be part of course, Operation Overlord, D-Day, the invasion of northwest France. And so the 1st Infantry Division is part of that. Flynn's regiment, the 26th Infantry Division, the Blue Spaders, don't get on the beaches until about midday, but they do arrive at Omaha Beach. The fighting is still going on. And he's, just like in Sicily, he spent a lot of his time conducting last rites for dying soldiers, sometimes not only assisting with the funerals, but helping dig their graves, and then holding, having confessions, arranging for the spiritual counseling for a lot of soldiers, because there were never enough Protestant, Jewish, and Catholic chaplains to go around. So just because he was a Catholic priest didn't mean that he wouldn't take confession necessarily, but you know, he would often provide spiritual advising and pray with Protestant and Jewish soldiers as well. It's just something that you had to do. And then also it was finding various places to hold mass. And he talked about how he went from everywhere from abandoned cow fields to an abandoned casino to abandoned estates. Like a lot of chaplains, he had his own Jeep, and he would use the hood of the Jeep as the altar. So anyway, he's with them through Normandy. He's with them through some of the battles in France and in Belgium. And then he he misses the Battle of the Bulge in the winter of 44-45 because he develops a case of malaria. He has to go back to the United States, to Massachusetts, to recover in the hospital for a few months. And he doesn't get to rejoin the 26th Infantry Regiment until the summer of 1945, when the war is late spring, early summer, when the war is basically ended. And then the 26th Infantry Regiment was assigned to Nuremberg. That was the specific city that they were assigned towards. And so that's how Flynn ends up with involved in the Nuremberg trials, because it's decided eventually that the International Military Tribunal will hold the trials in Nuremberg. I mean, there was no plan to originally. I mean, it always gets associated with the Nuremberg trials, but there was no long-term plan to host it there. The original plan was to host it, to have it in Berlin. There was some talk about having it in Luxembourg. But ultimately, it was decided to be held in Nuremberg partially for symbolic reasons, because the city was in Bavaria. Bavaria was one of the birthplaces of National Socialism. A lot of prominent members of the Nazi Party were from either from Bavaria or from Austria. Hitler was Austrian. And so Nuremberg was famous for all the massive rallies the Nazi Party would put together in the 1930s and in the early 40s before the war intervenes. So the idea was to have it there would be kind of a symbolic justice. Also, Nuremberg had a large courtroom facility with a prison nearby that had not been damaged by bombings. And so that made it a practical idea as well. The Soviets kind of hold out for a while. They want to have the trial in Berlin. But because the British, the Americans, and the French, particularly the British and Americans, have a lot more high-ranking Nazi war criminals in custody than the Soviets do, Soviets agree. Ironically, Flynn himself, when he was writing, obviously he's not editing Sign, but he's still contributing articles for them, he pointed out that Nuremberg, maybe it has good symbolic reasons and the courtroom's still there, but pretty much every other building was destroyed. It's funny. I mean, I go to Germany every so often, and it's so prosperous now and everything. It's hard to imagine a time, still technically in living memory, where large parts of the country, there was hardly a building standing and most of the road destroyed. And in Nuremberg, like most German cities, it was a humanitarian disaster. You have all of these people taken from all over Europe by the Nazis as slave laborers trying to get home. You have people who've been liberated from the concentration camps, but in some cases, since there's no place for them, they still have to stay in the camps. And then as soon as they get certain people out of the refugee camps, new people come in, because all these ethnic Germans from now what is Poland and Czechoslovakia are being expelled by the authorities there. So it's just an absolute mess every single day. And with most of the average German population just barely trying to survive, and basically the American authorities, as Flynn acknowledged, barely keeping order. So anyway, the 26th Infantry Regiment gets assigned to be the guards at the tribunal, and Flynn is made the official chaplain of the tribunal. And then he's one of two Catholic chaplains there. He's one, and then eventually, he eventually leaves the army in early 46 and joins Catholic Relief Services. I know we'll get to that in a later question. He's replaced with Father Sixtus O'Connor. The Lutheran chaplain was a man named Ralph Garricke. And so since Germany is still a majority Protestant country, and not like a lot of these senior Nazis were very observant anyway, but Garricke dealt with more of the German defendants than Flynn did, because frankly, more of them were of Lutheran background. But among the people that Flynn served as a confessor to was at least three defendants that we're aware of, two of which mentioned him in their own memoirs. Franz von Papen, who played a pretty big role in 1933 in bringing Hitler to power. He was the vice chancellor in the dying throes of the Weimar Republic, and he persuaded Hindenburg to make Hitler chancellor. And he helped negotiate the Concordat between Hitler's government and the Pope, Pius XI at the time, which was a big foreign policy victory for Hitler early on in power. Ironically, the Concordat is more or less still in effect today in Germany. And then Hitler eventually made him ambassador to the Holy See and then ambassador to Turkey. And then another man named Balder von Schirach, who was the Gauleitner for Vienna for a while after Austria's merger with Germany in 1938. And then for a long time, he was the head of the Hitler Youth. And then finally, a man named Hans Frank, who had been in the Weimar period Hitler's personal lawyer, and Hitler during World War II made him the governor of Poland. So Flynn met with these people, heard their confessions, met with them on a number of different occasions. For a lot of the defendants, the only people they got to meet with were their lawyers or the guards or the chaplains. And then Frank was sentenced to death, and I would argue deservedly so. Von Papen was one of the two people acquitted, and Schirach got 20 years in Spandau prison in West Berlin. But Schirach and Papen praised Flynn for not only assisting them, but also looking after their families. They both mentioned them in their memoirs. Because another thing, before we move on, Flynn was also put in charge of organizing a witness house outside of Nuremberg, where a lot of the witnesses for prosecution lived in, but also typical army bureaucracy at the time, it was also a house where a lot of the family members of some of the defendants were living in. So Flynn was in charge of finding this house. He finds this Hungarian countess who had fled when the Red Army entered Hungary to run the house and kind of supervise that from 45 to 46. So he had a lot of different duties.
And so after Flynn's involvement with the trials, he used to work with for Catholic Relief Services in Germany and Hungary. What is Catholic Relief Services, and sure, what was Flynn's role?
Okay, so Catholic Relief Services was founded as War Relief Services in 1943. It was founded by the National Catholic Welfare Conference, operating on the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. Its origins kind of go back to World War I. They had the National Catholic War Council. So it was founded in 1943 for the American Catholic Church to provide humanitarian relief for the victims of the Second World War. So the man put in charge of it was a man named Father Edward Swanstrom. He was a director of War Relief Services and Catholic Relief Services from the mid-40s to the mid-1970s, right? And he oversaw its overall operations. He was famous in the 30s and 40s for working, being a priest who worked with dock workers in New York City, helped to kind of expose the corruption there of organized crime. So any film buffs listening, if you're fans of the film On the Waterfront, Carl Malden's character, the priest there, is largely inspired by Swanstrom. So he helps set it up. He meets Flynn in Italy, because Flynn took a number of trips to Rome. They meet with the Pope. They're trying to arrange for Italian prisoners of war to be repatriated back to Italy. And his record during World War II, during the Nuremberg trials, deeply impressed Swanstrom. And so Swanstrom asked Flynn if he'd be interested in, once he left the army, in working for war relief services. And I'll just switch to Catholic Relief Services. It doesn't get that name until the 50s. But and Flynn kind of does this on his own, and he hadn't really cleared it with his order. And that's kind of another drama I get to in the book. The Passionist Order is like, you've been doing stuff on your own for 4 years. It's time to come back and rejoin the community. That's what Passionists are supposed to do. And basically, the officials in Catholic Relief Services keep telling Flynn's order, we can't spare this man. He's too valuable. Right. And so the order finally in the early 50s, after they finally get Flynn back for a year, he's put back to Sign magazine from 50 to 51. CRS asks for him again and they send Flynn back to them. And after that, they kind of give up on it. But they really made his life difficult afterwards. I like to joke that Flynn was the Passionist who maybe should have been a Jesuit because he would have had more leeway to have more independence. The funny thing is, Flynn himself sometimes had a low opinion of the Jesuit order. He sometimes would refer to them in his correspondence as those rogues and those renegades. But anyway, Catholic Relief Services worked with government authorities and with other relief agencies to distribute food and medicine clothing to people who were fleeing the effects of the war. Right. And also they helped administer a number of refugee camps, which, of course, in Germany and in Austria were full of them and would remain full of them until, frankly, the mid to late 1950s. I mean, I like to joke. Sometimes that's an issue with historical writing and our understanding of the 20th century, that history ends in 1945 or that what a lot of people are interested in. And, you know, the story goes on after that. And there's all these after effects of World War II that countries still have to deal with. So Flynn is first assigned to the French zone of Germany, he's in the city of Freiburg. So he's there for from 46 to 48. And then he gets assigned to Hungary in 1948. And I know we'll talk more about Hungary later. He's only there for a few months, though, because unfortunately for that country, Hungarian communists were seizing power and they were basically building a state modeled on the Soviet Union. So most of his staff in Hungary were arrested and he was arrested too and expelled to Austria. The technical charge was that he had abused his work visa by leaving Hungary too much. He does come back in 56 though. So then he spends from late 48 to early 49 in the American zone of Germany. He's in Munich. And then in 49, he is transferred to Austria, and he will be in Austria for the next 14 years, from 49 to 63. And he spends much of his time in Austria working with refugees. And I, for the most part, for the first 6 or 7 years, most of the refugees he's working with are what were called the Volksdeutsche, the ethnic Germans, expelled from Poland and Czechoslovakia, and to a lesser extent from Hungary and parts of the Soviet Union, and who end up either in East Germany, West Germany, or in Austria. And there they start to get joined by people fleeing political persecution in communist countries like Czechoslovakia, Yugoslavia, Hungary, but still the majority of the ethnic Germans. And then after 56, of course, everything changes because you get they'd gotten actually most of the ethnic Germans out of the camps. Some of them had gone to different countries abroad. Others had been integrated into West Germany or Austria. And it looks like by the mid-50s, Flynn's task is almost done. and Catholic Relief Services can start winding down its operations in Austria. The Austrian Catholic Church and its charitable arm Caritas can take over. And then you have the events of 1956, and that more or less forces Flynn to stay in Austria for another half a decade. But it was a huge relief on the Austrian government because they were having – Austria had experienced a lot of damages during the Second World War. And so private relief agencies played a huge role in assisting refugees in Austria because of that country's proximity to the Iron Curtain, and it was often amongst the first country to receive ethnic or political refugees.
So as you mentioned, the way that history is often periodized or conceptualized is 1945, right, serves as a convenient ending point for many periodizations. But you see sort of a continuation after that. And one of those sort of continuations is the Hungarian Revolution. Can you tell us a little bit about that the sort of geopolitical and historical context of the Hungarian Revolution and Father Flynn's work in Hungary and engaging that context?
Sure, of course. Well, Hungary was one of those countries during the interwar period that was an authoritarian regime. After the Habsburg Empire collapses in 1918, for a while, the last Habsburg king of Hungary, Karl, wanted to stick around as king in Budapest. Even after he left Vienna, the Allies wouldn't let him. So the Hungarian First Republic is declared in late 1918. And then that falls in early 1919. The Hungarian Communist Party sets up a Soviet Republic in Hungary, headed by the leader of the Hungarian Communist, Béla Kun. And it's only in power for a few months. But they try and build like a Soviet-style regime in Hungary. They invade Romania, try and extend the revolution there. It's a disaster. The Romanian army defeats them, invades Hungary, opposes the communists. Béla Kun flees to Moscow. And what you have is kind of an authoritarian government under Admiral Miklós Horthy, who was the former Grand Admiral of the Habsburg Navy. And technically, the state was still called the Kingdom of Hungary, with Horthy serving as the regent. But because they couldn't figure out who to offer the crown to, and the Allies wouldn't let the Habsburgs come back, one of the jokes was that Hungary was a kingdom without a king, led by an admiral, despite the fact the country had no coastline. So Hungary during the Second World War joined somewhat reluctantly into an alliance with Germany. Hungarian soldiers take part in the invasion of the Soviet Union. And then eventually Horthy realizes in 1944 that the war is lost for the Axis powers. He tries to negotiate a separate peace with the British and the Americans, and they more or less say, no, you need to negotiate one with the Soviets too, which Horthy was desperate to try and avoid, right? He didn't want Soviet domination of the country. But he decides to open up communications with the Soviet government in 44. Hitler hears of this. Horthy is overthrown, and a direct Hungarian fascist regime led by Fenrek Zalassi, the head of the Arrow Cross Party, that was the Hungarian fascists, they come to power. And they're only in power for less than a year. But it's a devastating time for Hungary, particularly for Hungary's Jewish population. Horthy's regime was somewhat anti-Semitic, but it had not deported its Jewish population, and Zalassi was eager to do so. So if you look at the deaths in the Holocaust, the last year of the war, a huge number of them are Hungarian Jews. Anyway, the Red Army takes Budapest on their way to Berlin in February of 1945. Zalassi, of course, is deposed. He's tried. He's executed. You have a period in Hungary for a few years of multi-party democracy. It's this period some historians like to call from roughly 45 to about 47, 48, after Hitler, but before Stalin. But by late 1947, the elections in Hungary don't go too well for the communists. The Hungarian Communist Party, and this happens in a lot of countries, East Germany, Poland, they force the Socialist Party to join with them. and to form the Hungarian Workers' Party. It was what were called salami tactics. The idea is first you go after the fascists, then you go after the monarchists, then you go after the liberal middle class parties, then you go after the peasant party, and then finally you go after the socialist, right? And once you've defeat them all one by one until there's no one left. And so this is a process largely completed by late 1947. And basically by late 1947, most of the other political parties have been banned. It's a one-party dictatorship under the general secretary of the Hungarian Workers' Party, Matyas Rákosi, who was nicknamed quite accurately as Hungary Stalin. And he immediately begins kind of a crash course of building Hungary along Soviet lines, following Stalin's example. And that includes the persecution of religion, both the majority Catholic Church and the minority Calvinist churches in Hungary. And pretty much once all the other parties are banned, the most prominent opponent of Rákosi in Hungary was Cardinal Mezente, the Cardinal Jozef Mezente, the head of the Hungarian Catholic Church. And so Mezente is arrested in early 1948. And he's put on trial, and he's subjected to these brainwashing experiments, which mainly involve just physical torture until he confessed to all these kind of outlandish crimes. Like, he wanted to bring the Habsburgs back, but he wanted to initiate World War III with assisting the Americans, with the idea that the Americans would put him in charge in Hungary after the war is over. And it was a huge trial, got a lot of public attention all over Europe. Pius XII, the Pope, excommunicated all the Hungarians involved in the trial. I mean, although Mezente wasn't sentenced to death, he was sentenced to life imprisonment, like a famous martyr of the regime. So along with, I'd say, Albania and Romania, the communist regime in Hungary was one of the most repressive of all the satellite states. And after Stalin dies in 53, for Rákosi, it's like, well, really, nothing's changed. We're just going to keep doing what we're doing. For a number of the other satellite states, like Poland, for example, and even Czechoslovakia, they relent a little bit on the purges, on the trials, on the huge demands of the workers to make more of the factories. Hungary doesn't do that at all. Okay, so in early 56, Khrushchev gives this famous speech in Moscow denouncing Stalin. He was told by other Soviet leaders, don't do that because of what might happen in Eastern Europe. Stalin built communism in Eastern Europe. The communists haven't been in power that long. It could have a destabilizing factor. Of course, Khrushchev, which was his habit, ignores him, does it anyway. And in Hungary, it leads to a big struggle in the Hungarian Workers' Party between those who say, okay, we should reform like Khrushchev wants. And this was centered around a man named Imre Nagy. And then Rákosi's faction, it's like, no, we're still following Stalin's example. And this drags on for months. And eventually, Khrushchev, who found Rákosi too difficult to deal with, he forces him to resign, sends him to Moscow. But he replaces him with his deputy, Erno Jiro, who is just as much of a Stalinist. So Jiro and Nagy are in kind of this power struggle. And then in neighboring Poland, which has also been having all these problems in 56, in October of 56, in Poland, you have all these riots and demonstrations, and it brings a Polish communist named Władysław Gomułka to power. And the belief was he had stood up to Moscow. He advocated a Polish road to independent path to socialism, didn't follow the Soviet model. So the Hungarians thought, if Poland can win its freedom, so can we. But since the Hungarian communist regime was so much more repressive, the events in Hungary go in a much more radical direction. You have eventually in late October, early November, you have street fighting in Budapest and a number of other Hungarian cities, as thousands of workers and university students and some members of the Hungarian army defect to the revolution. They target the Hungarian secret police, the AVH, for assassination. And Nagy announces in early November, as a way of kind of holding on to power, that Hungary will become a multi-party democracy again, and it will leave the Warsaw Pact. That was the Soviet equivalent to NATO. And for Moscow, for Khrushchev, it's like, okay, they can't do that. That's enough. And because of the fact that the Suez Crisis is going on at the same time, the world's attention is a little distracted, the Soviets launch a massive invasion of Hungary. And they crush the Hungarian Revolution. They put a new puppet government in place under Nagy's deputy, Janos Kadar. About 25,000 Hungarians are killed, about 5,000 Russian soldiers are killed, and then about 200,000 Hungarians flee the country because the Hungarian government can't close off the border temporarily. Most of them end up in Austria. And many of the Hungarians were kind of embittered because they thought the United States in particular would come to their aid if they rose up. They thought that, you know, Radio Free Europe and Eisenhower's talk about rolling back communism had encouraged them to do so. And the Austrian government, which had become like a neutral country in 1955, is totally unprepared for this. They initially put the Hungarians on trains and just kind of circle the country. And Flynn has to, and again, it wasn't just Catholic Relief Services. There are other charitable groups as well. But Flynn has to spend the better part of 56 until the early 60s trying to keep these people in as good of conditions as they were in the camps and trying to find new homes for them. And a lot, and eventually they do. I mean, some do go back to Hungary when Kadar gives an amnesty the next year, but most end up going all over the world. And the Austrian government, when it's all over, gives Flynn for the second time the Golden Cross Award, which is the highest honor that any non-Austrian can receive. And so finally, it's not until 63 that the situation calms down enough that Flynn can finally go back home.
So he goes back home after this time in Europe in different contexts. Can you tell us a little about Flynn's final years when he comes back to the United States?
Sure. Well, he does have to live in the Passionist community again in the Bronx, but he's still working for Catholic Relief Services. Okay. And he spends the next 6 years working for public relations. He's the chief PR spokesman for Catholic Relief Services, which is kind of, you know, PR is kind of a thankless job now, is a thankless job then. And so he spends about 6 years doing that. Some of the work there he's quite happy with. Others led to some difficulty for him. Before I get into that, he keeps popping up everywhere. He was also assigned as one of the American experts during the Second Vatican Council. He was at the first, second, and third sessions as a peritus, which is roughly an expert. The records of the Second Vatican Council, it's not like he shows up a lot making contributions, but he was definitely there. Might not have been there for the fourth session. And again, Rome was a city he was fairly familiar with. So he writes a lot of articles and pamphlets telling Catholics, this is where your money goes for Catholic Relief Services. We're not just handing money out. We're assisting people when they need it, that type of thing. But then again, Flynn can't get away from the big issues of the day. A country that had become one of the largest single recipients of aid from Catholic Relief Services was South Vietnam, Republic of Vietnam. And because of the conditions in that country by the mid-1960s, the agents of Catholic Relief Services were very dependent on either the American military or the South Vietnamese military to distribute aid. Right, to various parts of the country. Because parts of the country, you know, were occupied by Viet Cong insurgents, some were occupied by bandits, and of course the Vietnam War is a very controversial issue in the United States at the time, and even in the Catholic Church. And there was a movement in the Catholic Church, kind of the Catholic New Left, if you will, that was very critical of Catholic Relief Services for providing aid to South Vietnam. For a couple reasons. They said, one, you're too dependent upon the State Department and the U.S. military. And, I mean, technically that first part was true for a long time. A lot of the aid, Catholic Relief Services worked very closely with the U.S. State Department. Like a lot of the aid CRS distributed was provided for them by the State Department. The idea was you guys can just distribute it better than we can. And why aren't you aiding North Vietnam, too? Isn't this a violation of Christian teachings? And Flynn had absolutely no patience for all of them. And he wrote a number of angry editorials denouncing them. He would say, we worked in North Vietnam until the communists expelled us in 54. And for him, it was kind of personal. You know, he has seen communists come to power in Hungary before he was expelled. He didn't want that to happen again in South Vietnam. And he argued that this country is fighting for its life against tyranny. And of course, as Christians, we have obligations to do so, particularly against an atheistic tyranny. And so his struggles during that period, having to what he believed justify work that didn't need any justification, caused him a lot of psychological turmoil. And for people like him and Swanstrom, you see this generational divide. They're all from the, you know, the greatest generation. A lot of them were Army veterans. And the idea was America won World War II. We're the good guys. And there's no problem that can't be solved if we draw up a plan, we put enough resources to it. So it's fair to say that I think for him and for their ideological opponents in the Catholic Church, they're kind of talking over each other by this time. So he leaves that in 1969, and then he spends a few years working as the deputy director for Catholic Relief Services in Italy. And but by 72, his various health problems finally catch up with him, and he's terminally ill with pancreatic cancer. So he finally returns to monastic life after more or less 30 years. But he doesn't have much longer, and he dies in early 1973. And I talked to some of his relatives, and they said that when he was in the hospital, when he was before he got too sick to see anyone, and then the only person who saw him was Swanstrom, both there but also at the funeral. I remember one of them described it. It was like the ending of It's a Wonderful Life, when you had all the military veterans from World War II, representatives from the Austrian government, and representatives from German and Hungarian immigre organizations who all wanted to come and pay their respects to this man who did so much for them. So,
and so I'm interested in this, you know, this idea of like focusing on one man, one priest that did a lot. You know, the book's title, The Priest Who Put Europe Back Together, it makes a bold claim, right, about the role of Father Flynn in post-World War II Europe, and even during World War II. And there are many different, he was engaged in many different contexts, you know, related, but also with their local specifics. And, you know, there are many ways that you can approach, so you can do sort of an institutional history, military history, you know, social history. What do you think we gain when we sort of turn to biography and look at sort of big events through the life of one person, as you did in this book?
Well, I mean, when I do my historian's craft class, when we get to history as biography, I argue that there's a section of the historical profession that kind of looks down on biographies, that it's too popular of a form of history, or that it supports kind of the great man theory of history, right? But I've always believed that individuals make history. It's individual choices made by thousands and millions of people that drive history forward. And yes, decisions made by people in power do help shape historical events. But I wanted to look at Flynn because this is someone who wasn't at the highest levels of power, who was kind of at the mid-level. And it was people like him who are given tasks to be carried out to make the plans designed by those above them a reality. Whether it's, Eisenhower can make the order to launch D-Day, but it's people like Flynn to accompany the soldiers to try and improve their spiritual morale after make it a fact, right? And again, going back to Eisenhower, he can choose probably not to start World War III by invading Hungary and assisting the revolutionaries against the Soviets, but that's going to create a huge humanitarian crisis that, again, people like Flynn have to deal with, right? I mean, again, Eisenhower had said, we'll find these people a home. We'll do what we can for them. But it was people like Flynn who had to make it a reality. So sometimes I think you can learn a lot about events that, let's be honest, have been extensively studied, like the landings at D-Day, like the Nuremberg trials, like the Hungarian Revolution, by looking at the impact they had on different individuals and look at them kind of from a new light. And so, I mean, obviously, the book's title is symbolic in a way that it was Flynn and tens of thousands of others who put Europe back together. But Flynn and people like him played a vital part in that. And often the contributions of people like that tend to get tended to get neglected. And I was trying to avoid a hagiography. I mean, he was a very courageous man, and he definitely lived his faith. He could be very stubborn and sometimes self-righteous, and in terms of dealing with other people in Catholic relief services, if he had the perspective this was the right course to take, it was really hard to dissuade him from it. And so ironically, some of those characteristics that made him difficult to deal with were the things that helped him deal with certain tasks that were extraordinarily difficult.
Thank you so much for talking to us about your book. One final question. Are there any projects that you are currently working on right now that are coming down the pipeline that you want to tell us a little bit about?
Sure. I actually have two works under contract. The first is for Catholic Education Press. That's an imprint of Catholic University of America Press, which published the Flynn book. It's called The KGB versus the Vatican, the Revelations of the Mitrokhin Archive. It's about a man named Vasily Mitrokhin. He was an archivist for the Soviet secret police, the KGB. After the Soviet Union collapsed, he had been secretly for 20 years taking secret police documents home, transcribing them, and then bringing them back. Because, again, he was an archivist. He could do that. He offered his archive to the Americans first. They thought it was fake, so he offered it to the British. And so they got him and his family out of Russia and to the United Kingdom. And his archive is available. A lot of it's still in Russian. There's been a number of works published on it. But what I did was I took the stuff about the Vatican, about the Soviet policies towards the Vatican and towards the Catholic churches, the Catholic Church in the Soviet Union, both the Roman Catholic Church in Lithuania and the underground Greek Catholic Church in Ukraine. And it was only about 30 pages worth of material, but I translated it from Russian into English and then wrote kind of a historical introduction to it. And then just wrote some historical endnotes about some documents and certain things. So that's kind of a primary source collection. But it's been done for a while, so I'm really excited about it finally coming out. There's some interesting stuff in here. No earth-shattering revelations, but some fascinating stuff. And then just a few days ago, I signed a contract with Lexington Books to publish a book I finished. It's a history of the Cold War at the United Nations from 47 to 60, looking at the two American ambassadors there, Warren Austin and Henry Cabot Lodge Jr. So they're kind of like the focal points of it. So I like to joke, this is something, I mean, I'm a Europeanist historian by training, but lately I've been writing about Americans like Flynn, like Austin, like Lodge, who are deeply involved in European and global affairs. And again, I didn't plan it this way, but they were all old-fashioned New England Republicans too. So I guess that's just the trend I've been on lately. But yeah, those are two projects that will hopefully both be out late next year.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brennan, for talking to us about your book, The Priest Who Put Europe Back Together, The Life of Father Fabian Flynn, published by Catholic University of America Press.